So we have a cluster of items around the general heading of implementation and maintenance activities. And I'll turn it over. I think Alan is going to lead off on this.
Great. Thank you. I brought some visual aids with me today because I think it's helpful to get a sense of what we're talking about when we get this issue of core standards and basis for conclusions and so on. We don't expect to take the whole hour of this. I'm going to walk through the first part of our paper and give you some examples, and then Michael will talk about post-implementation issues, and Philippe Donyeau will talk a little bit about what happens in terms of our agreement with IOSCO and the relationship there as well. But essentially what I want to talk about now is about the package of items that we produce when we develop and publish a standard. And you'll see from the paper that we essentially, when we produce a standard, the very core concept that we have is that you should be able to pick up the standard itself and be able to apply it without any other material that goes with that. So just to give you a bit of a sense, and the bigger issues, but our bound volume, which comes out twice a year in terms of we have a green version, which is on the 1st of July, and another one on the 1st of January. We publish it in two parts, and part A, which is the thin bit, contains the standards themselves. Okay? And within the standards, we typically have at least three sections normally, what we call, I guess, the principles. We then have our defined terms and then application guidance that goes with that. That should be all you need. As it points out in the paper, we haven't always done it like that. IS 39, which was financial instruments, was the first standard in which we separated out the principles from the supporting material that went with that, the application guidance. Up until that point in time, we just wrote a standard and it was just front to end. The board decided for practical purposes that it might be easier to see the underlying principles if you pull those out and had those at the front end and then had the support underneath it that showed how those principles were applied. And so this is about geography within this particular standard, within each of our standards. Okay, there's nothing special about application guidance. It has exactly the same weight as any principle in there, and we make it very clear in the front of each document that every paragraph carries equal weight. So everything basically in here, this is IFRS. Our due process handbook makes it quite clear that you should be able to pick up this version, this part A of our book, and be able to apply the standards without it referencing anything else. We also publish with that part B, which is slightly bigger, and that contains two types of things. One is the basis for conclusions, and a basis for conclusions is trying to explain why the board made a particular decision, why it made a choice. It explains cost-benefit trade-offs they made, why it thinks it's better information. So it's all about explaining the reasons. So it actually doesn't tell you what the accounting is or explain anything about the accounting, just why they made choices. Included in the bound volume is another set of, I guess, information that goes there to support. You'll see from the paper we call it lots of different things, but essentially they're illustrative examples, and sometimes we call it implementation guidance. Now, those examples are generally there. You shouldn't need them to be able to interpret or apply the standard. A simple example that I use in the paper, and it's one I was familiar with, was when we developed IFRS 3, which is our business combination standard. There's quite a tricky mechanical debits and credits process and calculation process with something called a reverse acquisition. It's just a mechanical issue, but we thought it was helpful to provide an example of that in our part B, because without that, you're kind of without a teaching or learning aid. We don't tell you how to identify whether it's a reverse acquisition. That's in part A, and that should be where it all stands alone. And similarly, we've got lots of examples in here of things in IFRS 3. It tells you what a music copyright is, for example, the right to music, right to words, recordings and things like that. It almost is a bit of a textbook cut and paste of what some basic intangible assets are. We don't think you need that to apply the standard. Part A should tell you how to identify whether you've got an intangible asset or not. This just gives you some mechanical examples of it. Now, this is not about a US comparison to IFRS, but if you have a look at the FASB's codification, it's the equivalent of Part A. because they don't publish their basis for conclusions as part of their codification. They just publish their requirements in there. You've got to be very careful when you make statements like that, because when they did codify, they actually took some of their original basis for conclusions and codified that as part of the core and put that out for public consultation. So I don't want to say that the old standards, some of the basis was not included, because it is. But to give you a sense, I think theirs is about 7,500 pages long and ours is about 1,700 pages long. So the core requirements, we have much, much thinner ones than the US. Okay? As I said, it's not about that. One of the differences, though, between us and the FASB is the examples that they created in business combinations, like those intangible assets and the reverse acquisitions, they didn't put them in a separate book. The only place that they had available was in the main book. So their codification actually includes quite a lot of mechanical stuff that we don't include within ours. And that's one of the differences between us and the FASB, the way it operates. Now, we think we have a bit of an issue in that whenever we produce anything out of 30 Cannon Street, we talk about it having authority or being authoritative. We know from talking to the firms, talking to preparers, anything that comes out of 30 Cannon Street is deemed to have some authority, because obviously it came out from either the thinking of the board or the staff. And so it's deemed to have to carry some weight. Our issue is that we put a lot of due process, and you know, we talked this morning briefly about the due process requirements. They're very extensive to make sure that what we have in our Volume A is very high quality and has been through robust processes. When we get to a lot of the support material, such as education, whether that's something like a chief executive's guide to describing what a standard's about. We produced some examples of how to measure non-listed equity securities to help with our fair value measurement standard. We did that late last year. When we produce things like that, we don't necessarily want to have to go through a process of public consultation, board votes and all those things, when all we're trying to do is potentially give people a bit of a helping hand or a lift up to understand some particular issue. It's more, we think it's educational as opposed to trying to interpret a standard. So what we're looking at is ways to make sure that we make it clearer to people picking up our standards, what they're actually getting. You'd never like to criticise your own work in a sense, but I'll give you, there are some good and some not so good examples. And some of these are for very practical reasons. We produced in October last year an investment entities amendment to our consolidation standard, and it's not very long at all. It's about 60 pages. But it contains in here a core part of the standard, then you flick through, then you'll get to the basis, and you flick through, and you'll get some illustrative examples in there. And there's no differentiation, it's all wrapped around one red cover. So if you were to receive this in the mail, you have to have a good understanding of how IFRS works to be able to flick through and work out which pieces I know I have to work with, and which pieces are there just to perhaps provide some educational support. Okay? And the other factor to keep in mind is that the core bits, the main standard, and the application guidance, in other words, Part A, that's the only thing that actually goes to governments. Okay? So if you look at Europe and what's been endorsed in Europe, they don't endorse the full book, they don't endorse our illustrative examples. The only thing that goes through are the core standards, and that's the same in most jurisdictions. Okay? So this is the thing, if you went to court, that you have to stand and live by. So we have a couple of issues here. One is making sure that when we do produce a standard, that we provide the right amount of support. And I think we've had over the last 6 months or so a case of IFRS 11, which is our joint arrangement standard. It seems that there are some questions about interpretation of that, and we have to ask whether we've got the right amount of support for that. We endeavoured to produce some educational material to provide some additional examples, and we put those out for consultation in terms of a managed consultation privately with some target groups. The feedback we got was that many people thought the material was helpful, but they thought it was interpretive, and so we couldn't publish or issue it because we can't issue interpretive material without going through a public due process. And so we have a bit of a challenge we need to work through of identifying what how to differentiate between the core standard and the support material. What we proposed in the paper, and this is the, really one of the first questions, is that whenever we produce a standard, as I said, the Part A, which is really the standard, and the application guidance should stand alone. And so we think the application guidance itself should be about making sure you can interpret the standard properly and apply it properly. And we give an example in the paper of a case in business combinations again. You're supposed to recognise or bring in a business combination, all the identifiable assets, and then we tell you how to work with something like an assembled workforce, reacquired rights. They're quite tricky assets, and we didn't think that people would apply that consistently unless we provided good guidance in there. On the other hand, we think the education material, the way to differentiate that is to think of that as giving people a helping hand, particularly the first time at application of a standard. There's always an issue when you do issue the standard and it's new material. All of a sudden the firms and the companies don't have their precedence databases anymore because they've got new words to deal with. And so there's a little bit of uncertainty sometimes about what our intention is in terms of a standard. So we see the education material is about getting people up to speed. And one of the questions we've got for you today in the breakout session is whether you think that's an appropriate way to differentiate. If it is, the other issue that we have to be very careful is in terms of drafting these things as well. When we developed, I'll give you an example. I always hate using fair value examples because it's always controversial. But we do state in IFRS 13, our fair value measurement standard, that if you're doing an estimate of fair value and it's perhaps an unlisted security, and you might find an equivalent listed security and make an adjustment for liquidity or lack of liquidity because it's not traded actively. If we had an illustrative example that said, and the entity adjusted by 4%, then that by definition almost becomes, people look at that and say, ah, that must be the answer, 4% adjustment for liquidity. So we have to be very careful about the way we draft as well. So I think two things to think about. One is, how do we differentiate fundamentally? When we suggested education should be about helping people step up or read a standard for the first time, and then over time it doesn't serve any ongoing purpose, whereas application guidance lives with the standard and has a much longer life. And the second thing is we have to be very careful about the way we draft. So that's the fundamental issue. The second one is packaging. And what we've been looking at is whether or not we should actually change our packaging just slightly. The suggestion in there, we haven't made any decisions about this, is whether we should simply when we produce a standard, always, as we did for IFRS 10, you do two booklets. One red one, which says here's the standard and that's all you need. The basis of conclusions was in black and white, and that just explains how we made the decisions. And if we do produce any educational material, perhaps just put it on a website, so it's actually quite separate from this process. Alternatively, we could package it up. You know, it has been suggested we do a green cover, so you've got the red for the standard, the black and white for the basis, and green for education. But one of the issues that we have is that if you then publish a bound volume of education material at the time, what happens if you want to add to it later on, like we did with fair value measurement and the unlisted securities? Is it more or less important that it came out afterwards? And so that's what we're looking at, whether or not we should separate those and simply never publish hard copies of the educational material, but simply place it on the website. It would still potentially be exposed, but we would simply place it, as say, on the website rather than wrap it up in terms of these are normally wrapped up in basically plastic, so here's the package of goods that you buy. They look as if they all carry a similar type of weight. So that's the second question about is around about packaging. Now, we have thought ideally, in an absolutely ideal world, once whatever we publish with the standard, and if we should publish education material, we should publish it at the same time as the standard. So everything is there together. Ideally, we won't have to do anything again, because in an ideal situation, the principle will be clear, the application guidance will be sufficient, and the education material will help people quickly get up to speed, and we're done. We've done a perfect job. Unfortunately, it doesn't always work quite like that. So I'll hand over to Michael and see what happens in terms of after you've issued a standard.
Thank you, Alan. So I want to just sort of take us on now to the period of time after the standard's been issued. But I think it's worth just reflecting on some things that Alan has said. And obviously getting things right initially is where the initial focus needs to be, and looking at the right amount of support and making sure that it's coming out at the same time as the standard is obviously very important. But once it is out, then what next? And I want to continue with the theme of education. And really we find that in those initial periods after a standard's been issued, and Alan's already mentioned this to some extent, people start to look at the words in the standard and perhaps start to ask questions and start to question, you know, what was the board's intention in this particular area? And so we identify this as a period of time where what could we do to sort of help build people's confidence in the way that they read standards? And that's where the idea of hosting sort of public discussions about the standards has come from. Now, this is something that we've spoken to you about, certainly at the last meeting, the ideas about setting up a discussion group for the revenue standard jointly with FASB. But what we want to include, or what we've included in the paper for today's discussion, is sort of the more general idea of perhaps using a discussion forum in public to help tease out those areas where people are searching for confidence in the way that they read the standards, sort of sharing experience with how they are initially applying the standard, and perhaps through that, identifying whether there are certain factors, certain issues that should be referred to the Interpretations Committee. You know, we're not looking to create a new level of gap in the hierarchy here. Preliminary thoughts that we've got on these discussion groups would be that they wouldn't issue any guidance themselves. But they might well, in discussing these issues, identify matters for referral to the Interpretations Committee, or perhaps in some cases directly to the IASB. And I think this would be sort of one way of helping us in the challenge that we sometimes have when we receive issues into the Interpretations Committee, identifying what are matters that should quite rightly be discussed and potentially addressed by the Interpretations Committee, or what should be issues that actually we should allow practice to evolve, and given that we do expect judgment to be applied in applying the standards. And so being careful not to jump in too quickly before people have had the chance to apply their judgment. So the third question that we have in the paper today is about the use of these public discussions, and wanted to know your views on the use of those sorts of mechanisms for helping to bring people up to speed with the standards, so adding to that sort of education initiative and potentially using it as an additional source for referring issues to the Interpretations Committee. Then moving on to the Interpretations Committee itself, set out in the paper the responsibilities of the Interpretations Committee, and there's certainly no change here. You'll recall that about 18 months ago, the trustees concluded their review of the Interpretations Committee, and one of the main recommendations coming out of that was that the Interpretations Committee should use a broader range of tools for responding to and addressing issues that are received to it. And that identified that as well as doing interpretations and annual improvements, that the Interpretations Committee should be used for developing or proposing narrow scope amendments to standards, maybe additional application guidance or illustrative examples as well. And so this, I would see as sort of building on sort of the range of guidance materials that Alan talked about earlier. Just a word to sort of mention about the way in which we approach these issues in the Interpretations Committee. The focus is always, first of all, on the technical issue itself, and then having identified the technical solution, then identify what's the most efficient and effective way of then delivering that solution to the preparers of IFRS financial statements or to auditors, etc. So starting first with the technical and then thinking about the mechanism afterwards. In talking about the Interpretations Committee, I also wanted to just mention something about the interaction with the IASB as well. Now, one of the things that also came out of the trustees' review was the importance of the interaction, the dialogue between the Interpretations Committee and the IASB. And that is really very important in terms of the efficiency of dealing with issues. So I just wanted to mention about some of the things that I think you'll have seen happening over the last 12 months with regards to the interaction there. So as well as having members of the ISB who have a dedicated liaison role with the Interpretations Committee and who attend all of the committee meetings, we also provide ISB members with detailed briefings about the issues, the principal issues that are brought to the Interpretations Committee, so that if these or when these issues then make their way to the board for proposal for narrow scope amendments or interpretation, then the board's already had a timely sort of briefing about these issues, and the opportunity also to sort of feedback via the staff to the Interpretations Committee as those proposals are being developed. And on occasion, we've also specifically taken issues that have been in progress at the Interpretations Committee to the ISB to consult the board on its views on the issue so that that can then be worked into the developments in, that the Interpretations Committee is talking about. An example would be with the pensions, that the discount rate for pensions and the identification of high-quality corporate bonds, one that we've taken or sought the ISB's guidance on earlier this year and then fed that into subsequent Interpretation Committee discussions. And then finally, I just wanted to touch on maintaining convergence with US GAAP. Obviously, over the last 10 years or so, there's been a lot of efforts in creating or achieving convergence in a number of areas between IFRS and US GAAP. And we're certainly very mindful of the need to maintain that. So as we're looking at issues in the Interpretations Committee, looking at, and it relates to a converged standard, then we're very conscious to look at what the practice is in terms of US GAAP, speaking with FASB staff and incorporating that into the discussions at the Interpretations Committee so that we can sort of try and our best to sort of maintain that convergence. One example that I think we've used with you before on this would be with an issue that came out of the business combinations standards about a little over a year ago now, where we were wanting to go ahead and make an amendment to the guidance there. It's to do with deciding when you're acquiring an entity from shareholders who are also management. How do you split between sort of the cost of the business combination and management compensation when they're required to continue working? And this is one that we, in discussion with FASB staff decided, well, let's just put this on hold and wait and see what comes out of the post-implementation reviews, both that FASB were doing initially and that we're now doing now, and then we'll pick it up again later in conjunction with FASB and, if appropriate, EITF, to identify how we might sort of provide some clarity there and to try and do that in a converged manner. So our fourth question is looking at the additional considerations, or asking you about additional considerations that you think we should be keeping in mind as we're looking at the post-publication support for new standards. And I want to just hand over to Philippe to talk about interaction with IOSCO.
Thank you, Michael. In the interest of time, I will be brief because I think Michel Prada this morning in his remarks mentioned the protocol that has been recently signed between the Foundation and IOSCO. The reason why I'm coming back to this topic a little bit, first in the absence of Yael Almog, who is the CEO of the Foundation, she asked me to speak about it. I think in my capacity of chairman of the Implementation Steering Committee, and to a certain extent we are talking about implementation of the standards, and our committee, which is, as you may know, a committee set up within the board with many other committees as part of the implementation of the strategy adopted by the Foundation to focus more on the proper implementation of our standards. So we deal with those matters. So, as Michel said, the relationship between IOSCO and the ISB or the Foundation is not new. Actually, it started, my memory is correct, some 20 years ago when the IOSCO decided to support the development of an international set of standards. It was in 1995. Then in 2000, there was a recommendation or adoption at the Sydney conference by IOSCO, a decision to recognize IAS, as a word, it was before IFRS, as the standards for cross-border transactions. Then IOSCO was very instrumental in the organization of the new ISB, the new foundation. So the relationship is ancient, is very well developed, but it was, and I put aside the participation of IOSCO in the monitoring board, but it was so far a little bit informal. A lot of things happened, but were not really penciled down in writing. So there was a desire to make this, to acknowledge the existence of a relationship, to make it public, to make the public aware of it, and also to think of further developments. And the protocol that you may have on your package has two main sections. One is the participation of IOSCO in the development of our standards. And I would say this is not new at all. IOSCO has been participating, and Patrick Parent can speak about it, representing IOSCO today, in the development of our standards by giving comment letters and giving the opinion of regulators on the enforceability and on the quality of our standards. What is more a new development is a second section which deals with implementation of IFRS. And here the idea is to strengthen the cooperation or the interaction when it comes to identifying problems in the consistent application of our standards worldwide, to identify early enough the causes for divergent application and to exchange views on what can be done to reduce diversity or to eliminate it. Maybe eliminate is a bit optimistic, but at least to keep it under control. There will always, in a system where we are principles-based, there will be some degree of diversity, but it should be as small as possible. So the idea is to establish a system of exchange of information, exchange of views, to talk to each other, to participate in IOSCO's meetings, to have IOSCO participate in the work of the Interpretation Committee, which is already the case, and to have a very good and open discussion and exchange of information on implementation problems. So I will stop here, and maybe if you wish to ask any question, either from Patrick or from myself.
All right, well, we're not under time pressure, so on the other hand, we don't want to drag it out just to fill up the time. Any questions or comments? This is meant as background information to preface for a spirited breakout session. So, Alberto.
I want to comment on what Alan has just said. I mean, you can cry loud that only part A is the standard and all the rest is less importance, is less importance. But as you said, whatever comes out from Cannon Street will always be considered as authoritative. It's a fact of life. You may cry loud, but people will continue using the part B for the proper application of the standards. And if, as you said, I mean, we are given an example to clarify, to resolve possible potential implementation issues, how can this cannot be considered as authoritative material? Will always be. So my recommendation is not to issue, but to continue with the same degree of due diligence which you always put in the production of this material. I have another comment on what Mike said. Do we really need, with more comment, a doubt, do we really need another forum? A forum for, as you said, to identify implementation issues? Don't we have enough? You have the consultative groups, which you consult during the process of producing a standard, but you can always consult, because there are the people more knowledgeable on the subject, afterwards for the implementation issues, and then you have ASAF. Personally, I don't see the need for an additional forum of people. And possibly it will be the same people we always turn around in the same type of groups.
Well, you put a marker down, hold your fire. That's a point of view that I'm sure will be brought up in the breakout sessions as to whether this is a good idea or not. Just going down the line, Jerry.
Thank you, Paul. I know I'll get my licks in the breakout group, but I couldn't let that last comment pass. I think it was at the last meeting or the one before when the plans to form the group for the RevRec were mentioned that I had mentioned a concern by a couple of the Canadian life companies that of difficulties in implementation that they had run into operationally that were related to IFRS 9. And the comment wasn't that we needed this kind of a implementation process for all standards, but for extremely complex standards, the fact that people have had their opportunity to be in discussion groups and so forth beforehand is not a substitution for actually being in the middle of the process and trying to get through an implementation when even the accountants don't really know what the right answer is. So I would simply like to put a stake in the ground for the opposite side of that to say that for complex standards, there certainly is a need for such implementation guidance.
To be continued. Chenang.
Thank you, Chairman. Well, I fully agree with the first part of the Alberto's comments. And with that said, so from our experience, we got really help from the basis of conclusions and interpretative illustrative examples in understanding the contents of the IFRS. Maybe without those two BCs and IEs, we might raise many questions to ISB to understand what's the meaning and what's the point, several other things. Let me ask one simple question which is the related to paragraph 37 of Ordinal Paper 4A. It is saying, publishing illustrative examples and similar guidance in a clearly labeled education separate package helps to ensure that those examples and guidance are perceived as supportive rather than interpretative material. But maybe you want to say that it's just supportive material, not interpretative material. This is my question. Can you give us any example that any trial to understand illustrative examples as interpretative could result in misleading of the IFRS? Can you?
Okay. Can I give you two examples where I think it's appropriate to have illustrative examples, one appropriate and one where I think it's a bit risky. The disclosure, often when we have disclosure, we give examples of the way people might present tables, for example. And I think we do that in several standards, possibly IFRS 12, which is about disclosure of interest in other entities. And they're not supposed to be the only way of doing it, and we often present different disclosure examples, complementary, so that they overlap, so they can't be one or the other. They should demonstrate different aspects of it. And IS1 is another case where we have lots of examples of income statements and balance sheets and things like that, where you give different ways of presenting. So I think if you looked at those, you wouldn't say, "Oh, I have to do it like that," because you actually can't do both. You're having to sift through, and you get ideas that this is a way of presenting. The example I used before of putting a number in, I mentioned one example earlier about IFRS 13, fair value measurement, where you imply that the amount of the adjustment you might make for liquidity adjustment might be 3%, for example. If we're not careful, that becomes the hard and fast rule. And when we develop the examples for consolidation, when we have control with less than half the voting rights, we had to be very careful that we didn't just put an example in there that said, if you own 40% and say that this was a case of having control, because it's too easy for people to read that to say, there's the bright line, 40%. So that's what we're trying to avoid, is when we have examples where it clearly interprets the words and starts to put some numbers around something where we think that we want people to apply the judgment to that. And my point is, if we have an example that does interpret like that, we shouldn't call it education. It actually should be part of the standard because it's interpreting it.
I'll save my words for the discussion.
Fumio.
Yeah, thank you very much. The recent announcement of the cooperation between IFRS Foundation and the IOSCOT is 100% good. So I hope that the deliberations between these two organizations or the decisions should be shared by other stakeholders, like preparers or accountants, or other, of course, including IFRS Advisory Council to keep the transparency and also to be understood well by other stakeholders. So please consider this point. Thank you.
Christoph.
Just a quick question to Alan. Have you ever considered the usability of the current structure? Usability in a way of you've got the standard, you go through the application guidance, you go to the illustrative examples. People may find the old way in which you got it more together easier to swallow. And in particular, if we now
get to the point that whether I put something in volume A or B, in substance doesn't make the difference. We may call it a difference, but in substance doesn't make a difference. Then usability may be a factor to consider whether the current approach is the right one.
It comes up now and again. We do know that, I'm not sure which firms they are, but one of the firms I know, when we do split them like that, the first thing they do is they put them back together again for their own internal documentation. So structure's an interesting thing, but we haven't looked at it more fundamentally than that. The trouble we've got is, you know, we could have people talk about simplification programs and things like that. It's they're bottomless pits, so you've got to be very, very careful if you're going to embark on a program to simplify the way the standards are written or in the language and the structure. That becomes quite a big issue. I do agree what we're trying to look at is, if we were to write a standard from today, how would you actually do that? What's the clearest way of being able to read something?
Shuzhan.
Thank you, Chairman. And I just have a quick suggestion. I find that education materials are very useful and very helpful for our understanding and implementing IFRS. And I know that IFRS and IFSB and also the Education Committee have put significant effect in producing this material. But it's unfortunate that I find that the materials are not enough. They are very good, especially the education material on fair value management. They are very, very good, especially as explain the circumstances, the situation and conditions under which a particular valuation method is appropriate. So it's very useful. But so far, we can only find very few education material, and I suggest that we should publish more education material, especially in emerging economies. These are very helpful. Sometimes these are much easier to understand than the standard itself.
Thank you. Jeff?
Just a quick question, just for clarification. Can you please explain to us, you seem to imply that there is a non-mandatory illustrative examples and mandatory illustrative examples. And also conceptually, how do you make the difference between illustrative examples issued as part of a new standards and illustrative examples that you issued later because you needed to provide more interpretation? I mean, conceptually doesn't seem to me any difference between the two. You seem to make that difference here.
And unfortunately, our language doesn't help because we talk about implementation guidance and application guidance, and I'm not sure how they translate. But they could be translated very similar terms. We don't have illustrative examples typically inside a standard in that Part A. The examples are supposed to, illustrative examples are supposed to be more mechanical, debits and credits, calculations, for example, just a little presentation table to show how you might show fair values relative to their carrying amounts, for example, in IFRS 7. So they are more mechanical in their nature. The application guidance, which is the mandatory thing, are supposed to help you interpret the words. And that should be the differentiating feature. Okay, so it's not a matter of us just tossing a coin and putting one to the other. They should be to actually say, when you do want to find out what a separable asset is, how would you apply that to something like reacquired rights, for example, in a business combination? And we didn't think, as I said in IFRS 3, that people could apply IFRS 3 consistently without those extra words to help them out. So typically, we're trying to give a high-level principle and then enough guidance or interpretation of that principle so that they can analogise to other things and apply it relatively consistently. Whereas the examples are, as I said, are mechanical. I thought it was a very good example about the fair value measurement for emerging economies. That was one of the designs of that material, was to help people who aren't used to using fair values for non-listed securities to help them identify the appropriate techniques. It's not going to tell them how much of an adjustment to make, but it's going to give them some techniques. So it is helping people step up to the standard.
Jeff?
Just a follow-up. So this is the same thing applies to the second part of my question. the difference conceptually between lists of examples that are supporting a new standard, not necessarily as part of issued as part of the interpretation, and a list of examples that came up later to this for additional interpretation or for additional needs. Is that the same thing?
Yeah. Again, go back to the case of the fair value measurement. We identified that there was a need for more help in terms of non-listed securities, particularly amongst emerging economies where the valuation methodologies were less mature. So we thought that was meeting a new need, so that we put that together as a package.
We're here. Jeff.
Thank you. Just a question. We now have a fairly formal, fairly thorough post-implementation review process that historically we haven't had, right? So how does that work into the thinking about when we should have an implementation group following the issuance of a standard? I mean, doesn't the fact that there is now this very formal, thorough post-implementation review process have some impact on whether or not you should have an implementation group following the issuance of a standard?
I'll answer that question with a question if I can. There's a few people from the firms around here. If we said, look, we know the words are a bit unclear, but let's wait 5 years for the post-implementation review, they wouldn't be happy. And so we've actually acknowledged the post-implementation review process that dealing with either lack of clarity in wording or what sometimes happens is after you issue a standard, people then craft contracts in a slightly different way that we hadn't anticipated. And you have to be able to deal with those and see whether it's an interpretive issue or something more fundamental. The post-implementation review is more about seeing more fundamentally how the standard is bedded in and whether it's meeting its objectives. So I think they're slightly different processes. And people are, you know, it's one example that we could have used for interpretation side. We often say we can't deal with that, it's part of a current project. Well, that might mean uncertainty for another 8 or 9 years in some cases, and that people don't find that helpful.
Riaz.
Another issue, which is probably a small subset from the interpretation. Sorry,
I think we need to move on. There are others who wish to speak. If we have time, we'd come right back to you.
Just a quick question. For other standards, usually there is, for those who assess the application of the standard, there is some kind, there's always a work to do, an assessment methodology, which is also related to how you implement and interpret. Is that something that is considered for the IFRS?
Yeah, no.
Riaz.
2 points. One, this proposed implementation group for revenue recognition, I'm a little confused as to what the authority behind that group's work would be. Will it be like a subcommittee of the interpretation committee? And the second point, if I can ask both questions, is that application guidance and implementation guidance, I know has been explained today, but trying to translate that into other languages, I think, is going to be a challenge. I'm just wondering that if application guidance is mandatory required to understand the standard, but shouldn't we just merge that with the principles and have implementation guidance as non-mandatory supportive material?
On the group, the group that is going to be set up with FASB, still working out exactly what the terms will be for that, but there is no intention for that to be issuing any interpretative guidance. That would still be the respective roles of the Interpretations Committee and presumably for on the FASB side, the EITF. Your second question was about the different pieces of guidance. Was it to do with translation?
Saying is trying to get the nuances between what is application guidance and implementation guidance in a translation is not easy. I'm saying that if application guidance is mandatory required for an understanding of the standard, shouldn't we just merge that with the principles and have one document which is mandatory and the other one which is supportive to illustrate the standard?
And that was the gist of the proposal set out in the paper today. Yes.
Riaz, leaving aside the problems of translation, I'm sensing a lot of people find it difficult to appreciate the nuances even in one language. So.
Just one clarification on the earlier one. So what exactly is this, the authority behind this revenue group that is going to be established? What will they see? For example, if they say, okay, this is what you are saying, this is what the standard says about what the principle is.
Riaz, could I ask you to hold your, if I understand and appreciate the concern that you're expressing, but that really is the sort of thing we should be discussing in the breakout sessions. I think you've heard the official position, which is it's meant to be non-authoritative, but I hear many people around the room saying no matter what label you attach to it, it may take on unwarranted. And I think that's a terribly important issue that we need to sort. So would you indulge me on that account? Karen.
Just an observation, and I appreciate, Ellen, what you're trying to do with characterizing these examples. I think the differences are subtle enough that the vast majority of the people who use IFRS are not going to understand them. I think that's become a little bit clear from the discussion. And I think regardless of how you try to differentiate them, if you put out a publication that has IFRS and your logo on top, it's just going to become gospel from a practical perspective.
Yep.
Well, there we have it in a nutshell. It's the challenge. Sorry, give last word. But
thank you. I just would like to say that I agree with the fact that the implementation guidance and other aspects are authoritative. When you apply the standards and their principles in good faith. But, and there's a but, when you are facing a disagreement with either your client, if you're an audit firm, or your issuer when you're a securities regulator, it makes a difference between both, because at least in Europe, only the standards are approved and endorsed, and that's the only thing that is within European law. So you have to take this into account.
Well, I think that's an excellent preliminary canvas of some very important issues, and it is, I think, very much a trade-off between a sincere desire to be responsive to real problems in practice, real questions, without having that help take on more authority than is meant, and whether that's a viable proposition or not. And my reflection, an example of this that I went through, was actually from the perspective of a standard setter. When the board was debating earnings per share, it was tough enough to figure out what the words were saying, let alone what the number crunching might look like. And that was an instance where every few paragraphs we paused, put it in a box, and said, you know, to make sure we're on the same wavelength, here is a little example that shows how it works. And that might be an extreme case where it was really interlaced. Speaking from personal experience, without that sort of thing, I suspect many of the then board members would have not been very comfortable voting for the standard. May not be even today with them, but and if that's true for the board, coming back to the point that Karen and others have made, is, you know, that same need is as strong or stronger when you get to others who aren't so closely engaged in the full debate. So thank you. That's been very helpful. We're right on track. Tea and coffee is in the breakout session, so that's the carrot. And if we could, we have an hour and a half allotted. If we could be back not later than 4:30, we'll be right on track. Your breakout assignments you should have in front of you. I believe two groups are here in this room and two elsewhere. So thank you.